to run these days so smoothly and seamlessly. So, as you mentioned, today is somewhat a continuation of yesterday, although today I'm going to be dealing with a very specific area of. But so I want to do a little bit of recap just to catch up and to know where we are for those of you who just came today. So I began yesterday by just mentioning the fact that when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, he didn't go through the world and through the rest of his life proclaiming and celebrating some kind of experience or some kind of state that was limited in time to a particular event. He didn't go through the world encouraging people to have the same experience or the same state, because the Buddha recognized, I think, as we all recognize, that there are, of course, a range of wonderful, quite delightful and quite profound experiences that can be born through meditative deepening. There are many wonderful and profound and inspiring and illuminating states that can be gained through meditative deepening. But of course, the real heart of the Buddha's teaching was not about states that that come and then might go, as inspiring as they may be. The Buddha was more directly concerned with the understandings that liberate the heart. He was more concerned with the insights that are pivotal in bringing suffering to an end. And it's very important to make that distinction between states and insight. You can have states without insight. And you can have insight without states. So it's very important to make that distinction, that the real direction of the Buddha's teaching was aimed towards this more enduring transformation, discovering for ourselves the way to bring confusion, the way to bring struggle, the way to bring anguish to an end. And when he got up from the Bodhi tree, he very much spoke about those understandings, the understandings that liberate, the understandings that awaken. And one of those core pieces of teaching which are very universal is the understanding of what are called the three characteristics or the three universal laws, the three marks of existence. And of course, from the perspective of the Buddha's teaching, although we experience these three characteristics personally, they are universal. They are universal. They are part of all of our lives. So the Buddha spoke about anicca, impermanence, instability, spoke about dukkha in all the different ways that I spoke about dukkha yesterday, and I hope you remember that, and not just the limited domain of dukkha, of suffering. And he spoke about anatta, the understanding of non-self. And he said, for anyone who sees deeply these three universal laws, suffering comes to an end. The causes of distress are uprooted. So they are so, so central. Now, the interesting thing for me, and I'm sure hopefully for all of you, is that what the Buddha taught was not really news to anybody. It wasn't news to anybody. You know, the Buddha didn't get up from the Buddha tree and say, you know, by the way, I really saw change. Isn't that amazing? You know, I never saw that before, you know. And it wasn't news to anybody. Dukkha is not news to anybody. It's not news to us that we're mortal, that we, you know, suffer with the instability and change runs through all experience. You know, it's not news to us that we live within certain cyclical habit patterns that are repetitive and familiar, that certainly do cause distress. So, you know, what's important is that this is not news. You know, it's not sort of startling information It says, oh, I never thought of that. But what the Buddha recognizes is that there is such a big difference between intellectual knowing and understanding. There's such a big difference between conceptual acknowledgement and insight. And there's a certain frustration, isn't there, when we know something and yet we act completely contrary to what we know? It's quite frustrating, I'm sure you would agree, that we know something, but that's not how we live our lives. And so the Buddha was very mindful, and I spoke quite a bit about this yesterday, about this experience of dissonance. You know, the gap between what we know and how we live. And that is the difference between, you know, just a conceptual knowing and a genuine understanding, because the whole point of understanding is that it leads us to align our lives with that which we know, with that which we value, with that which we deem to be most worthy. That insight leads us to live in the light of all of that. And that is the challenge of the path, isn't it? It's the challenge of the path. Is it, you know, that frustration of knowing something and yet acting or living contrary to it. It's often referred to as a kind of conscious incompetence. We know exactly what we're doing and we know where it goes and we're doing it anyway. It's not like we're thinking that there's going to be some different outcome from this moment of aversion, you know, or there's going to be some different outcome from this moment of craving or agitation. We actually know where it goes. You know, it takes only a little awareness. And we feel that frustration of almost being at times, especially for people who've been in practice for a while, a spectator upon our own disasters. And this is a point in the path. And, you know, how long does that point in the path last? There's no defining answer to that. It's very easy for some people to become quite disheartened and quite filled with doubt at that point in the path, feeling, well, you know, it's not working for me. You know, I'm still doing this. I'm still caught here. You know, it's not working. And for some people, that's met with that hindrance factor of doubt, frustration, feeling disappointed, feeling disheartened. But I think the Buddha truly recognized how intractable many of our patterns are. This is also a point in the path, I think, where we learn a lot about the paramis. We learn a lot about patience. We learn a lot about compassion. We learn a lot about forgiveness. We learn a lot about generosity directed towards ourselves. And actually, those are very crucial learnings. Very crucial learnings. So I want to just go through a short list of what we know. Okay, just go through a short list of what we actually know. We know about change. We know about impermanence. Our whole life has been teaching us this, hasn't it? Teaching us about things that arise, things that pass. Our whole life has been teaching us almost the lessons of loss. We know about uncertainty and instability, all of the ways that our world can crumble in a moment. And we know that we cannot find stability in a world of changing conditions that we cannot control. We know this. We know about dukkha. All of us know about meeting pain. All of us know that we have no exemption from the first ennobling truth, even though we may still heroically seek for that exemption. We know that to live in a world governed by craving, fear, and aversion only has one outcome in emotional and psychological pain. We know this. We know the power of generosity. We know how that gladdens our hearts. We know how it brings spaciousness and non-clinging and ennobles our lives. We know the value of mindfulness. We know that it's a far more profound and meaningful way to live in this world with wakefulness than with forgetfulness. We know that the most forgetful moments in our life are also tending to be the moments that we suffer the most. We know the role that mindfulness, awareness, wakefulness plays in caring for ourselves and caring for the world around us. We know the power of kindness and compassion. We know this. We see its healing power in ourselves. We see its healing power in the world. We know that it's really not an optional extra, that it truly is the most noble way to live. So we know all of this. We know to some, and most of us would not argue with or disagree with that list so far, I don't think. Okay. If anyone disagrees with it, we might speak later. And to some extent, so let's come to this last one that I want to talk about today, views of self. Now, on some level, we know about anatta. We know that it's difficult to pinpoint a fixed, enduring, independent self. This tends to be the area of insight, and indeed the area of knowing, where more argument arises. Tends to be the area where more argument, more disagreement arises. And in truth, I think within the world of the Dharma, you know, this whole domain of insight has been an area of ongoing discussion, ongoing argument. But we certainly feel to be a self, don't we? I mean, when you got up this morning, you certainly knew who you were, I hope. This is probably the most intractable view, that I am me. I am a self. This belongs to me. This is who I am. I make things happen, or things happen to me. Now, we have a lot of mixed feelings about this, I think. There's almost like these two extreme views. One is the extreme that, you know, I am just kind of eternal. I'm solid. I'm real. I'm substantial. I am me. The other extreme is that there is no self. And you do hear that phrase, I think, thrown around a bit in some Dharma circles. And it's very difficult for people, because it doesn't ring true that I'm no self. You know, it speaks of a kind of nihilism. And, you know, actually the Buddha said, if you were going to adopt a view, you would be actually better off adopting the view of being an eternal self than of being no self. That the view of no self has huge implications which are not helpful. First of all, you would probably have some degree of psychosis. You would probably have some degree of psychosis. You know, I have met people who've had severe brain injuries that come with a total amnesia where they've forgotten who they are. You know, and they don't have a narrative anymore. They don't have a self-story anymore. And I think some people looking at that from the outside would think, wow, what a relief. Not so. Total anxiety, total fear. The other danger, I think, of pursuing that view of no self, it means that there are no ethical implications to any of our actions. It would be very easy to say, well, you know, it wasn't me. Of course I kicked you, but it wasn't me. There would be no ethical implications to anything that we do. And, you know, all of you will know how very central and how essential the Buddha placed ethics in the path of awakening. So I do feel there's a danger in going down that route. But what we do see is probably that our views of self are likely to be the most intractable sankhara, the intractable, most intractable pattern within our world view. It seems central, doesn't it? The center of all things is me, you know? And the world revolves around me. I mean, when you look at your thought patterns in a single day, it's kind of tiring, isn't it? Do you just get tired of yourself sometimes? Do I really have to do that one again? But we hear the me-ing, the me, you know, the I need, I want, I like, I don't like, you know, I have to have, you know, I'm going, I'm planning, I'm remembering, you know, I'm making things happen, you know. It's kind of like the background hum of self. It's pretty present, isn't it, in most of our actions, most of our thinking, most of our views, most of our relationships. We hear the me, me, me. So it's hard to get, you know, the illusion is evident. You know, this is who I am. And I look at you and I see yourself, you know, and I see all the ways that I define yourself, just as I have all the ways that I define myself. However, we do see how that changes. With mindfulness, we do begin to see how our view of self is a constantly changing and shifting view, isn't it? Moment to moment, day to day, morning to night, we have this shifting view. Yet even as it shifts, it still feels centralized. It still feels centralized. And, you know, it's a very difficult nut to crack, isn't it? Even people, you know, very deep in meditative practice, you know, will ask the question, well, who sees? You know, who's aware? Who is thinking? You know, we're so convinced that somewhere, or hoping perhaps, somewhere there is an eternal me. Even though it changes its shapes, we're hoping there's still an eternal me. So this is the most intractable pattern. We see how it's centralized. Centralized in our experience. And it's productive, isn't it? Views of self are very productive. In fact, when we look at any kind of unskillful or unwholesome pattern, it is generated by a view of self. So there's this kind of output from self-view in terms of how we think, how we see, how we perceive, our fears, our anxieties, our angers, our areas of clinging. There's this sort of output that is being generated from the view of self. And it is mostly in the other patterns that are unskillful and unwholesome. But of course the difficulty here, and I hope this doesn't feel too grim for you, is the difficulty here is that the output that is generated by views of self in terms of the unwholesome, greed, anger, delusion, anxiety, that those patterns in themselves feed back, don't they, to further solidify and deepen the self-view. So there is this closed feedback loop that's going on between self-view, its productivity, the sankharas that are produced, feeding back, to solidify self-view. Now, you know, this is, of course, the danger of mindfulness, as you become aware of this. That's why some people say, I was much happier before I began meditating. You become aware of this, and yet it can feel so stuck. It can feel so impenetrable. It can feel so repetitive. It can feel so, in a way, so imprisoned. In a way, so imprisoned. So this was the challenge of the teaching of anatta, which I think was challenging to people 2,500 years ago. I think it is challenging to people today. The Buddha did not promote annihilating self as a useful answer to this feeling of being trapped. He spoke about the possibility of liberating the heart from all views. Liberating the heart from all views, including the view of I am. Including the view of I am. Certainly did not describe this as an impossible quest. In fact, in truth, described it as being very, very possible and very, very immediate. It is useful, I think, in our practice to, the Buddha very clearly said, investigation is probably the most important factor of awakening. And investigation actually sometimes makes us uncomfortable. It highlights that which we don't really want to be that close to. But it highlights that which we don't want to be close to. But in a way of curiosity rather than in a way of blame or judgment. And that is very pivotal. So we become interested. We become interested in views of self, views of me, and how they're shaped, and how they're formed, and how they pass, and how they change. We become interested in it rather than identified with it. And that is the challenge and the invitation of the practice. But investigation is the factor that brings that into the foreground. The willingness to ask those questions, how am I in this moment? How would I define myself? And sometimes I almost encourage people to sort of write a little bit of an autobiography for themselves, moment to moment, beginning each phrase, each sentence with I am. I am in this moment. I am the body, my thoughts, and my feelings, and my mood, and my mental state, and my pain, and my dullness. To have that sort of sense of what is my self-definition of this moment? Just as a question that you would pose to yourself. The value of mindfulness, I think the value of investigation, is it tends to interrupt this momentum of productivity. The moment I say, I'm my dullness or I'm my pain, you can see the productivity beginning to generate, my aversion, my fears, my anxieties, my strategies. So the value of mindfulness and the value of investigation is to begin to bring a pause moment into all those productivity patterns. And it's almost a question, is it true? Is it true? So this is basically, I'd like really to encourage this as our investigation of the day. It's not a project. It's always good to make a project out of these things, but I think it is useful to have a certain intentionality in our practice. I think it's too easy for us, especially people with more experience, to feel like, if I sit down and close my eyes, that's kind of enough. And we don't have to often ask the question, but why am I closing my eyes? Why am I doing this? What am I actually investigating? And rather than making a project, I think to have a certain intentionality, I feel, is quite useful. To have a certain intentionality that just sits in the background of your practice. And to have that intentionality of really being mindful of the sense of I being formed. The sense of self being shaped, moment to moment. And how that is being shaped, the factors that are actually shaping that. So it means looking very carefully at our minds. Looking very carefully at what our minds are doing, being aware that our thought patterns matter. Some of them are very benign, some of them are just background chatter or commentary. And then actually to feel the energetic nature of a self being formed. because this is a very energetic experience. I hope you're aware of that. You know, if something displeases you, you know, or something offends you, if something irritates you, don't you just feel me entering the scene? It's a very energetic contractedness. And it's really useful to be tuned in to those moments of that energetic contractedness and to be curious about it and to see that it can indeed release, it can indeed relax, but it requires us to be mindful of it. And if you can, just holding that as a sort of background intention in your practice today, you know, because you do not go through life, by the way, selfing in every moment. As much as we might hold that as being, I'm an eternal me, we actually have countless moments in a day where selfing is not happening. And then you see the movement into selfing. And it's a very energetic movement. I mean, you got up this morning, you probably brushed your teeth or took a shower or ate breakfast. You know, I actually may not have been very present. I mean, me may not have been very much in charge of those moments. And then, you know, you go out or you listen to something or you see something or something, there's a moment of contact that triggers a reaction and you feel that energetic contractedness arising. That is the moment of giving birth to a self. And to have a sense of how that arises and passes in a day. It might be happening right now. It might not be happening right now. I would like to invite you to consider the insight the Buddha proposed that the view of self is a habit. It's an eruption. It's an impulse. And it's a sankhara or a pattern, a habit pattern. Now, if we were to consider that view or that insight, then, if the view of self is a pattern, an impulse, it is triggered by what in Buddhist psychology is referred to as contact. Okay? The meeting of a sense door, the sensory information, and the knowing of that sensory information. The eye, the sight, and the seeing. The mind, the thought, the thinking, the ear, the sound, the hearing. This moment of contact in the Buddhist teaching is the beginning of where we start to construct a world view, our world of the moment, our world of personal experience of the moment. All begins with this moment of contact. This is also the beginning of the arising of sankharas, or habit patterns, including the habit pattern of self, or the inflammation of self, the agitation of self. If I give you a simple example of this, you know, if you go out into your walking practice, and you're quite happily planted on your walking path, not necessarily a whole lot of selfing going on. You might be just quite spaciously, mindfully walking up and down. And someone comes through the gate talking in very loudly, perhaps on their cell phone. Okay, it's just a very simple example. The ear hears the sound, there's the hearing, and then the process begins, doesn't it? Oh, that shouldn't be happening. You know, I really interruption. You know, I really don't like this. You know, I wonder if someone's going to do something about it. But you can see the energetic contracting and the self of the moment being born, can't you? Really hate this. You know, I never get a moment's peace. You know, who is that person? So you feel that energetic contractedness. Now, how long will that last? Depends how long you feed it. Depends how long it's fed through thinking, through dwelling, through proliferating, through deepening. And how that feeding also deepens and reinforces the sense of me in that moment. You feel that energetic contractedness. And then conditions will change. Perhaps you'll remember that you don't actually have to do that. You know, perhaps you'll see a bird flying in front of you. There's a different contact moment and suddenly that whole world kind of dissolves. And suddenly there's a return to a sense of appreciation or spaciousness. And with that return, you know, in that return to a sense of appreciation and spaciousness, you can actually feel, and it's a very felt sense, that energetic contractedness of selfing begin to soften and begin to fall away. This is why I encourage you today to be mindful of that rise and fall, that almost that birthing process of a selfing, of a self of the moment, how it's sustained and how it falls away. And this is not something that is a kind of abstract theory. This is very much a felt sense through all of our experience, this constructing of the world of the moment, beginning with contact. Beginning with contact. You may be out in your walking meditation and, you know, again, quite happily, quite spaciously, no particular big self event going on. You know, just walking, enjoying it. You get a pain in your shoulder. It's that moment of contact. And you can feel the world beginning to build, can't you? You can feel the contractedness beginning to build. Oh, my shoulder. That's the first. It's a good starting point. My shoulder, you know. Oh, it's that pain again, you know. Oh, my arthritis is returning. You know, and you can feel the self being shaped and formed. And it's this very energetic contractedness. Again, something else can arise, another contact moment, and you can feel that fall. Now, the moments of selfing tend to have quite loud voices. You know, they really draw the attention. The moments when that's not happening tend to have much quieter moments. So our attention is really not drawn to those moments very much at all. In fact, these are often the moments where we kind of just feel like nothing's happening. You know, I'm not happening. Nothing's happening. And yet they are the moments of actually resting in a non-constructed moment of selfing. And just really appreciating that shift in the day, that rhythm of the world being born, the rhythm of the world, of that moment dissolving. If you can, this doesn't make sense to you. Okay, just kind of tune into that, just as a sort of background intentionality. Well, have a walking period now for half an hour, and if we come back at 25 to